Today's Teisho will be on case 75 in the Book of Serenity. Case 75 is entitled Ryuan's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Case. Ryuan asks Yanto, what is the fundamental, constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree with me, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. This is the final day of our beautiful spring session, and I want to thank everybody for doing a good job, and I want to encourage you to continue to sit so deeply. People have been coming into Dokusan, and it's just been wonderful. It's a pure pleasure to practice with people who are sitting so open-heartedly, and. It's just, this is an ideal, I mean, if you're in the Zen teacher business, this is great, you know, things are going well. People are trying, you know, they're making a sincere effort, they're really engaged, you know, it's perfect, you know. I teach at a university and I teach introductory courses, so I don't always have engaged students. Say, I have a student in my class right now, you know, she's actually failing the course, and I'm very concerned about her, you know, and so she failed her first paper, and I said, would you please come and see me? And she said, well, I have a class right now. And I said, well, I'm available, you know, all week long, you know, please come in and see me. Okay. It never showed up, right, you know. Okay, so paper number two, you know, same thing, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, I've sent her emails. You know, I'm very concerned. You know, so I'm baffled. You know, but this is my life in a way. You know, I teach students, some of whom want to learn and some of whom want anything but to learn what I'm trying to teach them. So it's a real pleasure to work with people who are so highly motivated and receptive. You know, that's really great. Thank you. You know, this is the last day of Sesshin, and we're transitioning outward now. You know, you come to Sesshin, and it's a special place. It's, you know, you need a place like Sesshin to accomplish certain things. You can't really do this in the ordinary culture of our society, right? You know, our society has many values, you know, success, wealth, competitiveness, you know, and so on. It would be a wonderful day and an odd day, you know, if I were walking down a street in New York City and a bus drove by and on the side of the bus was a picture of the Dalai Lama and it said, seek enlightenment, or, you know, wake up today. You know, that is not the dominant value in our culture. We all know that. And so, you know, we haven't created a culture that values what we're engaged with here. And so, you know, people leave the world, so to speak, outside, you know. We turn off the television. We turn off our internet connection. We get in the car. We drive to Sesshin. You know, there's very few distractions. We spend 8 or 9 hours a day watching the breath or working with a koan. We eat wonderful food, really amazing food, and the whole environment, it contributes to our robust health. You know, so not only is this a diet very good for you, but the mental diet is very good for you too, you know. And the people come into the Dokusan room and I say, how's it going? They say, wonderful. You know, I'm just having like beautiful, joyous sits. Like, okay, you know, wonderful. You know? That doesn't always happen to people I run into in my everyday life. You know, how's it going? Oh, great, I'm having a wonderful, joyous day. You know, that, I usually don't get that response, you know. So, oh, how's it going? So this is quite important, right? I mean, we constantly underestimate how much our mental life is a function of the environment. We hugely underestimate the importance of the proper environment. We create this space, people come here, and as I've said, Sesshin is like a machine for enlightenment. You know, the people who designed Sesshin in China about 2,000 years ago came up with a system that would actually produce a situation like what happened this morning, where somebody, how's your sit? Wonderful, I'm having really joyous sits. You know, they knew how to do that, and they've engineered this whole system to create that. We should be grateful to them. And there's a lesson here, you know. If we live carelessly, if we live mindlessly, we're going to suffer, you know. And if we live a life that's a little closer to Sesshin, we're going to be happier. It's just a fact. You know, this is an environment on every level that's designed to produce alertness, attention, compassion, happiness, you know. So our society, of course, is quite far from this, but there's a space called Sesshin where people can come and do this periodically and renew themselves, right? Sandy mentioned, you know, a metaphor I often use for Sesshin is karma hospital, you know, where you get knocked around a lot, right? And finally you have to go to karma hospital and recuperate. And you get up at 4:30 in the morning and, you know, you eat special food and you go to bed at 10:30 at night. And basically within a couple of days, your temperature's back to normal, you know, you're functioning, and you're in robust health, you know. So this is like karma hospital, and you should try, if you're interested in practicing Zen, to get here as often as you can, you know, because when you leave here, the chances are you'll be happier than when you came, you know. So this is very good, right? There is this issue, though, the world out there. You know, we come here, and this is a machine for enlightenment, and then we leave here, and we go into a world which is not a machine for enlightenment, you know. There have been cultures which get very close to being machines for enlightenment. You know, before the communist revolution in Tibet, something like a fifth of all Tibetans were in monasteries. Isn't that astounding? It's like basically you had this huge monastic population. A fifth of one out of, what would that be? One out of every 20 people? Is that right? No, 20 out of every 100. Sorry, English professor. You can can see what happened. 20 out of every 100 people, right, basically were in a monastery. That's a huge number, right? So I'll try to move quickly past that math mistake. Put that out, please put that out of your mind. You know, that's an amazing commitment, right? And in ancient China, too, you know, there were, just as we have public schools and public universities, in ancient China, there were public temples. And anybody who wanted to pursue enlightenment could show up at a public temple. Just, you know, it was like free meditation, actually. I mean, until, it's very sad what's happened to public education in America, because just before I went into college, back in the 60s, there were states where if you could get to the university, if you could get accepted, you went for free. That was not uncommon 50 years ago. There used to be free higher education in many states, even California. That was a fact. You know, so you could go to Berkeley for nothing if you could get into the school. And so all you had to do was pay your room and board, you know. It's very sad that we've turned our back on that, you know. But in China, they had like free enlightenment for all. So if you were inclined, you know, you could just pack your bags and go and enter a temple, and you could practice Zen primarily. You know, those cultures really valued this. There are stories about Zen temples where they're having a sesshin, and they raise a flag, and the flag signals to the town that sesshin is going on, so everybody will be quiet, you know. Isn't that amazing? Is it what a different, it's like, we have to be quiet, they're in there trying to wake up, you know. That's amazing, right? You know, hey, Louie, you know, cab driver, don't drive by the temple today, you know. Oh, yeah, sesshin. Very different value system. Okay, so it's not Tibet, right? It's not ancient China. People don't necessarily value what we're doing, and the values in the culture can be almost a little toxic sometimes, right? You know, people can be very very competitive, not always friendly, you know, you can begin to feel boxed in. You know, you can feel overwhelmed. And you can say, what happened to my beautiful, peaceful mind? You know, so you come to sesshin, you're all wired up, you're tense, you're feeling boxed in. You know, you have 2 days of this or 5 days of this, and you go home. You have this serenity, you get back at the office, and you know, you make the mistake of opening your computer, and there's, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, you know, and then the adrenaline's pumping up, you know. You know, a week later you can say, what happened to my beautiful, peaceful mind? You know, now, let me just say that this is going to happen to you for a while if you practice Zen. It's going to happen. You're going to go to sesshin, you're going to enter this beautiful state, and there are times when you're going to come home and you're going to feel this huge disjunction between the world of sesshin and the world of chaotic daily life. And that's something that's all pretty much inescapable for a while. But part of Zen practice is gradually working through that sense of separation. You know, that sense of separation is an illusion too. And that's also an illusion, you know. There are other illusions I'd like to talk about. But this sense that there's the world of peace and stillness, you know, and then there's the world of craziness and chaos and no stillness, that's an illusion. It's one that seems very real at a certain stage in your practice. But ultimately, you know, there's a more advanced kind of practice, which is to be in the flow as it's emerging, with a kind of non-discriminating mind or unified mind in accord with the way. This is difficult, you know, but it's something everybody should aspire to achieving. The illusion is that we can control what's unfolding, or that we can have a kind of we can have, as the moment is unfolding, the same sense of stillness we have on the cushion. I hope that makes sense. You know, there's a kind of stillness and peace and focus that comes on the cushion when your body is absolutely immobilized. Then there's a kind of activity which is unified activity, and it isn't going to feel exactly like that stillness. It's not. And if you're craving that stillness, you're not going to be able to go to the next stage and be in this active mind. Okay? I hope I'm making some sense. So the art of there's a deep samadhi on the cushion, which comes from this deep stillness, and it's essential to be able to get to that place. But in your daily life, there's another kind of samadhi, which is, you might say, going with the flow samadhi, going with the flow samadhi. And if you try to have the experience of stillness as you're in the going with the flow samadhi, it just doesn't work. You have to be moving outward with events. You have to be, it's moving samadhi. Move, not stillness samadhi, moving samadhi. Earlier in the session I said, if you think you understand what's happening in your life, you are living in illusion. And I would like to underscore that. If you think you understand what's happening in life, you're living in illusion, because life is alive. And it's constantly changing, and it's actually unpredictable. We have this belief that someone, somewhere, knows what the future is going to be like. But, you know, the truth is, and this is the Buddhist view too, the universe is a complex system, and it's open-ended. And it's unfolding in every possible permutation, in every possible way. And it's not predictable. It's a complex system. And so there's nobody who actually knows how things are going to work out. Nobody. So even the Dalai Lama doesn't know, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to shake your faith in Buddhism, but the truth is, you know, the Dalai Lama didn't know the Chinese were going to invade Tibet. You know, I have friends who really deeply believe that the Dalai Lama has, like, telepathic powers and so on. And he'd say, well, he keeps them hidden, you know. And it said, well, you know, he didn't see the Chinese coming, you know. And yet, you know, there's no question in my mind that the Dalai Lama is a very deeply enlightened person. So the truth is, nobody can predict the future, you know. I hope I'm not making you nervous, but it's just a fact. It's a complex system. Okay. So we need to have a kind of openness and trust in events as they unfold, even though we can't know where they're going. See? Even though we can't know where they're going, and we can't control them. This is the most advanced kind of practice. This is the most, so it's difficult, but it's the most advanced kind of practice. It's a kind of world embracing practice. See, I finished my training when I was. Something like 33 years old, when I finished my Zen training, when I was 33 years old, and a couple of teachers passed me and said, "You finished your training. You know, you are. You know, here we'll give you our seal of approval." And I thought momentarily that my life would not be the way it was before. You know. I had imagined that there was pre-enlightenment and post-enlightenment, and it worked like this. Pre-enlightenment is you're caught up in the flow of events and you don't know where they're going, and you turn this way and then you turn that way and you're uncertain and so on and so on. And then there's post-enlightenment, and post-enlightenment is like this. No problems, man. Always serene, never surprised, right? Always calm, always in control, right? Everything's perfectly okay, you know. I imagined that, you know, and that is actually not the truth, you know. It's not the truth. The fact is that I studied with two people who were really deeply awake, Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi. And I have to confess to you that sometimes they were people who had had the Daikensho experiences. They were very respected in the world of Zen. Sometimes they made mistakes. Sometimes they didn't know what they were doing. Sometimes they were thrown for a loop, you know, thrown for a loop. And they didn't know which way to turn, you know. Genki Roshi was, his baseline consciousness was really like very kind and funny. He was a very kindly, funny guy. But sometimes he could just be, he could be really immature, you know. He could just be immature. He'd be like a big baby, you know. And Webb, has become a very warm person. But when things would go wrong, Webb would become very withdrawn, you know, very withdrawn, and sometimes not very helpful, you know. So I realized that these people have had Daikensho, but they're not, you know, they're not able to cope with all the events as they're happening. And that they don't have omniscience, you know. Now, this could be like a terrible shock. You know, as I say this, people could be getting up and leaving the room, you know. Like, well, what are we doing here? You know. So what are we doing here if it's not giving us omniscience and total, you know. I mean, but if you think about it, that's a very unrealistic view. If the world is really open-ended and alive, you're imagining that somebody who's had Daikensho has finished, he's learned all he or she ever needs to know. And that's not possible, right? In a world that's open-ended and alive, that you would expect that somebody who's had Daikensho would continue to learn new things in a changing universe, right? The universe is constantly changing. Events are constantly, it's like a kaleidoscope, right? The reality is like a kaleidoscope. It turns and it turns, and there's always these changes of shape. And it requires different adaptations and different strategies all the time. So if you're imagining enlightenment as this final achievement where there's nothing further to learn, that seems to me very, not just unrealistic, but kind of sad, you know. One of the things that I thought was most interesting about both of my teachers was how they kept learning and growing as human beings. So Genki Roshi came to the United States, and it was a major, major adjustment for him. He came to the United States when he was 50 years old. And he was used to a monastic, he had been a little boy monk, you know. He had grown up in a monastery, and suddenly he was living, we had a Zen house in Seattle where all these hippies lived. This was like, yeah, you know, the flowing skirts and, It was not a temple, and it should have been more like a temple, because all these hippies thought, oh, well, we'll all live in a house together and do Zen. And so Genki Roshi had a room at the Zen house, right? And there's everybody had a little Buddha decal on the back of their, Volkswagen, and, it was a swinging place. And then, Genki Roshi would notice, one night she would go into his room. And, then they'd come out together in the morning and come down to sit, But then, on another night, she would go into his room, right? Or, say, wait a minute, They're not married. They're sleeping together. They're sleeping with different people, right? So it was like a commune. It was like the Zen commune, right? And it blew up, It was a really bad idea. There was no discipline, and Genki Roshi was like, he'd just come out of a monastery, right? And he was, all these people were, and he would talk about some of this in his Teishos. He said, I went into the bathroom, and I looked over next to the toilet, and on the hamper, there's like half a hamburger, and like a Coke or something. He said, wait a minute. What's this doing in the bathroom? And he would say, when you eat, you should eat. And when you go to the bathroom, you should go to the bathroom. And not mix them up. That's not Zen. No, but he really said that, I swear to you. He found that very upsetting. In Japan, we eat when we eat. When we go to the bathroom. And he it blew his mind. It blew his mind. He had trouble, dealing with this, And yet, he adapted. He tried to learn English. His English never got really good, So one time we used to sit in the morning and have breakfast every morning. We'd all come and at 5:30, sit till 7, and then have a Japanese-style breakfast with rice, miso soup, and vegetables. And one day, Genki Roshi, he came in and he said, Friday, Derox, Derox. Okay, so what did that mean, right? I interpreted that I was the Inji or the Roshi's attendant, and I thought, he means deluxe. So we put on a big spread on Friday, right? And we put this big spread. It was like wonderful, special foods, and then Genki said, he looked, and we sat, and we all sat, seizav with our knees under us, no talking, and we ate. And at the end, Genki came up to me and said, "Derox, Derox, Friday, Derox," I don't know, deluxe. I did what he meant, relaxed. Relaxed. He meant we could talk. See, Friday we didn't have to sit seizao, we could sit on the cushions informally, we could talk. That's what he meant. It took me a while to figure this out. But he kept learning, he kept growing as a human being. Webb, too. Webb came back from Japan and started the Seattle Zen Center and brought Genki, and then he began to be interested in tea ceremony. And he began to do tea ceremony fanatically. He became a totally engaged by tea ceremony. He eventually went to Japan. He studied at Urasenke, the great tea institute. And he would spend his whole summer doing tea ceremony and studying tea ceremony. And now he actually teaches at Urasenke in the summer. He's one of the world's foremost tea experts, tea ceremony, chado experts, So these people grew emotionally too. Webb used to be a very reserved person, very little stiff, but now he's very warm and funny. He's like almost like a totally different person. So he grew in response to off-the-cushion events that are unpredictable and chaotic, no doubt, he and Genki, I saw both of them flummoxed, groping, pissed off, not at their best, struggling to grow and to be fully developed beings, fully realized human beings. And they had both had daikensho, but it didn't like make them immune to those things that happen to everybody, right? You know, we all have these moments when we're not at our best. We all have these moments when we're confused, you know. And yet, you know, they kept going. They kept going with a kind of confident heart. And I think that's so much what this is about. You know, it's about not, you know, sometimes life just knocks us flat. You know, it just knocks us flat on our ass. We feel totally defeated. You know, maybe that hasn't happened to you, but it certainly happened to me, you know. There are just times when it knocks us flat on our ass, you know, and we just think that's it, you know. And there's a certain mentality where we say, I just want out, you know, I just want out of here, you know. And, you know, and sometimes people in despair check out, you know, they check out. And sometimes they check out in other ways, right? You know, they start drinking, they take, you know, drugs, they check out, they dissociate, they leave the world, you know, in certain ways. And I think that, you know, basically this Zen training, sometimes I've come to Sesshin and I've just been knocked on my ass and I feel totally dead. And I just want to check out. You know, and then around day three of Sesshin, I suddenly feel it's like, huh? You know, it's like, I think life can be a little bit like this. On the surface, everything's okay. And then when you peel away the surface, sometimes you see there's an underlying sadness. And then you peel away the sadness and you see there's an underlying joy. You know, it's very interesting. You know, I think Sesshin is like that, you know. You sit down on the cushion and there's your underlying sadness. And then you practice for a few days and suddenly you think, God damn it, I'm happy. You know, I don't know why, you know. But it happens to people all the time. And I've come to Sesshin and I've just been knocked on my ass. And I wanted to check out, you know. I don't mean I wanted to jump off a bridge in Seattle or something. But in my heart, I wanted out, you know. And then I've come to Sesshin and it's like, boom. You know, everything is alive again. And I feel like I'm ready to go back into the chaos, you know. And I think that this is something that Sesshin gives us, this kind of resilience, a kind of resilience. You know, we get burned to the ground. We get, you know, and yet, you know, if you do Sesshin for a few days, you find that there's this joy. You know, here it is in the middle of all this bleakness. There's this joy just welling up inside. And suddenly you think, okay, I can do this. I can go back. I can deal with this, you know. And then, you know, life really can be like this adventure. And it's not the last time you're going to get knocked on your ass. So there's a kind of a you know, you say, okay, I'm ready. You go out, and then you get knocked on your ass again. And then you say, oh, back to Sesshin, you know, back to Karma Hospital. Do some zazen, you get back, you go back out again, you know, and this goes on and on, but all the time you're becoming, you're growing, you're maturing, you're becoming a more compassionate person. You know, in Zen, this is compared to like a bag of, you know, when people train in a monastery, they're like a bag of stones that all have rough edges, you know. And basically, you know, in a monastery, people are trapped, you know, right? They all live together. They all have their, you know, problems. You know, so-and-so is roommate with so-and-so, and so-and-so snores, and so-and-so says, you snore too loud, etc. And then finally, they move into separate rooms, you know, but then they're in with somebody else, you know, and you go through this for 20 years, and finally, you don't care if he snores, you know he's annoying in certain ways, it doesn't matter, you know. I love the guy anyway, you know, he talks forever, he never talks, you know, whatever, you know. And, you know, you get beyond that. It's like the stones in the bag rub against each other, and at first they're rubbing, driving each other crazy, and after a while they all become smooth. You know, in the verse on this koan, you know, they talk about the smooth edges, the edges getting rubbed away, and finally you're smooth. You know, and an old monk in a temple is smooth, you know, because and we become smooth in life. You know, at first we have a lot of rough edges, you know, but by the end, you know, if we keep growing and changing, if we're not afraid to keep growing and changing, you know, we lose our rough edges and we become very round, you know, very adaptable, very, very shiny and like a beautiful polished stone, you know. And it takes a lot of sand and grit to produce that kind of polish and that kind of flexibility, you know. So these problems that we have in life are really essential to our development as human beings. We can't really change and grow if we don't have these situations that test us, you know. There's a larger perspective on this that I would like to just say something about, you know. We all feel that we all feel at certain moments in our life like we would like to check out or like we wish it would stop. And it, you know, there's some belief systems where this is actually made like the highest good, you know, actually. You know, for example, in some traditions in Hinduism, you know, this world is compared to like filth, right? Like dirt. This world of form is seen as unwholesome and world of suffering. And we want to grow up out of the muck of our physical and temporal life and become like a lotus of pure spirit. So we're moving from matter to pure spirit. We're moving from the filth and confusion of this life up to the lotus of pure spirituality. See, this is a standard way that some traditions in Hinduism think. Also, in Christianity, you know, people very often say things like, "Well, we're going to he's dead. He's gone to a better world." I think that's very, very unhealthy, myself. I really do. I mean, with all due respect, really? He's gone to a better world? It's better to be dead, right? Now, of course, we're imagining something else, right? Another world. But all the same, I think it's an unhealthy mentality. I really do, you know. The Buddhist view is that the Mahayana Buddhist view is that this world is not the filth out of which the lotus grows. This world is the lotus. This is the lotus. This is your life. It's sacred, 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 sacred. So please live it. You know, live it. Because this is the lotus. It's not somewhere else. This is the only lotus. This universe is the only lotus for us anyway. So live it. You know, don't, you know, we're all afraid. We're all uncertain all the time, but this is our lotus. This is the adventure of your life. This is your life. You know, it's sacred. See? So this is a very different outlook from, you know, this is the lotus coming out of emptiness. It's like the universe labored for countless kalpa to make this moment possible. It's very special to be here. And it's very special to be confused, overwhelmed. It's a great opportunity to be alive. A great opportunity. Now, the other Mahayana view is that actually, you know, early Buddhism was a little bit like Hinduism, right? It was the idea is that, you know, basically this is a filthy world and we want to get out and nirvana is like extinction, like blowing out a candle. Done. Free. But the Mahayana view is quite different. It's like, if you go into the deepest mushin, absolute nothingness, all of a sudden you hear a bird, right? It's like, there's a bird. It's so beautiful. Right? Something is constantly emerging from nothingness. It's an unstoppable process. In a certain sense, there is no escape from existence ever. In a certain sense, there's no escaping existence. You know, and if you're awake, you don't want to escape existence. See, there isn't such a thing. The early The early Buddhist view was, I want to take care of myself. I want to achieve enlightenment, and then I will be free. Free. So I'll do my zazen, I'll become an arhat, I will live in a cave until I'm dead, and then I will not be reborn. I won't return. That's an early Buddhist view. But the later Buddhists came along and said, wait a minute. You know, there isn't such a thing as an isolated self. You can't exist without all these other things. The universe is like this golden net. There's not just one person. There's no such thing as individual enlightenment. The whole universe is like a big machine coming into awakening, see? So the Mahayana view is there isn't a problem with existence. It's our mentality that makes it seem like a problem. All of this is, everything is unfolding in this magnificent architecture. Everything is taking us towards enlightenment. All sentient beings are moving towards enlightenment through the process of embodiment and life. See, this is the teaching. So this life is a wonderful opportunity. Everything is helping you wake up. You should just say that every day. Everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. This is the teaching. You know, and being alive is a wonderful opportunity. It's the whole universe has labored for kalpas so you could be alive. Yes? And so the attitude of world embracing the moment is on the cushion, stillness, absolute motionlessness, deep samadhi of the immobility. There are certain conditions of mind where you feel the absolute immobility of certain kind of samadhi. If you go into deep mushin, however, you'll be in this blankness that seems dead and motionless for a long time. But then the most amazing thing happens. Out of that blankness comes this extraordinary energy. So out of emptiness, out of nothingness, comes this extraordinary creative energy. This is the Mahayana view. This is the heart of Zen practice. And that is the energy of life. Out of the nothingness comes the life energy, see? So, it's going to be chaotic. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be madness, right? You know? And you have to work on your practice off the cushion is saying to yourself, everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is helping me to wake up. Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? In other words, what is it that absolutely doesn't change? What's continuously present? What is the absolute fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, change. The only constant is change. And Ryuan says, when moving, when changing, what then? And Yanto said, well, when you're in the middle of change, you can't see it as a fundamental constant principle. See? He said, don't expect to be in that same state as events are unfolding that you are in when you're seated on the cushion on day 3 of Sesshin. It's not going to be the same. You know, but you have to, it's a little different practice. You have to embracing the moment, moment by moment as it unfolds, you see. I won't take too much longer, but when I finished my Zen training, I got a job. I finished my Zen training. I got a job at the University of at Rutgers University, and I drove out in my beat up Volkswagen bus, and my wife and I rented a U-Haul truck, and we put all of our possessions in the truck, and we drove out across the country. And I got here to Rutgers, and the guy I was hired to replace hoped I would fail at my job. I got to my office, and all his stuff was in my office. He hadn't even cleaned out his office. It turns out he had quit because they didn't give him a raise. He quit, and they hired me, and he was the person who was in charge of hiring me. He picked me because he thought I would fail. And he thought when I failed and fell flat on my face, right, they would go, okay, George, here's your raise. You're indispensable. Okay. I got into my office, and he hadn't even moved his books out. Everything was there. It was like, you're going to be here for 6 months, sonny boy, and then you're going to be out. Okay, and I had days where, I'm telling you, they were 10-hour days easily, you know, maybe longer. And, you know, I had these incredible experiences. They were just, you know, there was a guy, there was a teacher in our program who, his name was Jeff. You'll never figure out who he is, so I'll just tell you, his name is Jeff. Jeff was teaching our research writing course, and around week two of the semester, I got students coming into my office, and they said, we want to complain about our teacher, Jeff. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, well, the course hasn't really started yet. And I said, well, what do you mean? It's week two. And he said, well, the books haven't arrived yet. He ordered the books late. So I said, well, what are you doing in class? And they said, well, we just go to class and he just talks with us, and then we go home. So I thought, well, that's terrible, right? So I called Jeff up and I said, Jeff, you know, come on down to my office. He came in and I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, the books will get here someday. Anyway, he wasn't teaching the course, and the students were complaining, and I said, look, you've got to start the course, and he didn't start the course. And I had to do something which was I had never done before. I had to fire him. And I actually did fire him and replaced him. And then his wife, who was a big professor at Rutgers, came into my office and screamed at me. And I'm not kidding. She actually spat in my face, which is a new experience for me. Wow, I didn't think anybody did this anymore. But she was so mad. She said, you're not worth my husband's little finger. And she really spat in my face. It was like, wow. You know? So everything is helping me wake up. it was like magic. Honestly, it was like a magic. It was like a magic talisman. You know, I would come home and do my zazen, and I realized that this, you know, it really worked. I realized this is the adventure of my life. You know, I didn't. You know, I mean, there were things about my situation that I did kind of feel were messages from the Bodhisattva realm. You know, so for example, Murray Hall, the abbreviation for Murray is Mu, right? So all my things were addressed to Mu. You know? Of course, this makes perfect. The universe is sending me a signal, right? Also, my office is 108, and 108 in Buddhism is the number of perfection. Really? So my office is Mu 108. I'm still there, 25 years later, right? You know. So I thought, this is a message. You know. Of course, that's crazy. But what isn't crazy? What isn't crazy is I was meant to be there, right? Things cannot be other than they are. You know, this is the unfolding of the universe. I wound up running this program at Rutgers University, and I had all of these problems, and they would take me all day, and I'd just nibble away at them, and I would come home and do my zazen and get up every day and just say, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping. And did I was I always calm? No. Did I always know what was going to happen? Never. Was I always off balance? Yes. Yes, always off balance. That's you are always going to be off balance, you know. And if you say, oh, I long for the stillness of my cushion. See, that's a big mistake. Now you're not in the moment anymore. You know, you have to be one with the unfolding of events. There's a time to sit on the cushion. At the end of the day or at the beginning of the day, you sit on the cushion. and you're in the stillness samadhi, the motionless samadhi of mu. And then you go out and it's moving mu. It's active mu. And you're always off balance. There's always something you didn't see. You're always making mistakes. And you just keep saying, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. So you can say, well, what if you've already had Daikensho? You're still waking up. The universe is constantly changing and growing. You are constantly developing as a human being. If you could achieve the stillness you want, you would have to be dead. So fortunately, not dead yet. So please realize that there's a time to sit, and there's a time to be confused and off balance, etc. But just keep embracing this beautiful life. You know, you're going to be like that stone in the bag. Every time you have a challenge that knocks you on your ass, and you sit down on the cushion and you come back to life, you're a little smoother, a little more adaptable. This wonderful, wonderful opportunity. Everything is your training. Everything is your training. Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see it as the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking, Yanto said, if you agree with me, you are not yet free of sense and matter. You're in illusion. And if you disagree, you're also in illusion. Okay, so you'd be forever sunk in birth and death. Okay, verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't yet polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. Resting on nothing, unique and alive.